From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Following last week's discussion about women and blacks in American writing, Soundings now presents another conversation on American literary history. My guest is John Seeley, a professor at the University of Florida who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. At the center, John Seeley worked on a project entitled Beautiful Machine, Rivers and the Emerging American Republic. Beautiful Machine follows John Seeley's first volume on rivers in American life, a book called Prophetic Waters, published by Oxford University Press in 1977. Beautiful Machine examines American culture in the years between the French and Indian Wars and the Civil War between 1755 and 1860. The discussion with John Seeley begins with comments about the origin of his study of rivers and American literature.
Well, there's a very specific moment. Most projects like this are cumulative. In a certain sense, this was cumulative. But I had been commissioned to write an essay for Triquarterly, which is a periodical published out of Northwestern University, on Henry David Thoreau. This was back in the early 1970s. And for the first time, I read Concord and Merrimack, that is to say, Thoreau's Week in the Concord and the Merrimack. And because I had been working with Melville in the past, with Mark Twain, with Cooper, I had built up unconsciously a sort of mental file of materials. And it suddenly occurred to me that one way in which we could look at American literature, at least an important aspect of American literature, would be by way of the rivers, how rivers could be seen as a motif, a theme, a structural device that would pull all of this together. The first work of literature that I deal with are the journals kept by George Washington when he made his several, I guess the modern word would be incursion, his several incursions into the Ohio Valley. Now, the reason I regard Washington's journal as a work of literature was that it was prepared for the press. It was used as an instrument of propaganda. The next journal he kept involved the next journey he took, which was as a commander of the British forces. He was supposed to attack the French forces, but in effect he was attacked first. Mm-hmm. And had to retreat. The journal he kept was captured by the French and was used by them for propaganda purposes. Hmm. So in both instances, we have a major document kept by a very important figure in our history, which reveals to us the spirit of the time, as it were, how people regarded the land and the water running through it. These are works like Washington's journal. There are some minor novels involved, but I won't bother you with those. But they are, for the most part, works which see rivers in the landscape as providing the means by which the United States, as an entity, will be truly united. You mm-hmm. must remember, we're talking about a time when roads were very primitive, when the railway was yet to be really developed. It was rivers and canals which were seen as the vital units mm-hmm. that would enable what was then thought of as a relatively perilous union. You must remember that the western states, the territories west of the Alleghenies, were at one time regarded as possibly not remaining loyal to the United States, as possibly forming an independent unit or sliding off and forming an alliance with France or with Spain. Mm-hmm. The revolt of Aaron Burr, which took place during this period, suggested just what might possibly happen. So it was seen by Washington and Jefferson and others of their position that it was very necessary to in some way or other bridge those Allegheny Mountains. River exploration, river travel, river riding down through, let's say, arbitrarily 1825, which marks the completion of the Erie Canal, which realizes the great plan that the forefathers had, is for the most part positive and geopolitical in emphasis. River riding after it is either, in the case of Harriet Beecher Stowe, definitely political with a negative a force, or in the case of, let us say, Thoreau, apolitical. It has to do with expressing ideas, missions, and so on, outside of a political context. But Thoreau brings it all back home.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, what happens to him is all relevant, ultimately, to his largest political statement, which is in Walden.
Now, are you saying, John, that that whereas Rivers initially had, the key word you said was union, all of a sudden, in the second stage, Rivers in American life and literature take on a sort of an ironic, or they take on tensions that weren't there before.
Paradoxical would be the best word, I think. Okay, take the Ohio River, for example. Now, it was called the Beautiful River by the French. It is, still is, a lovely river in many ways in terms of the landscape it defines. But on one side of the Ohio was Kentucky, and the other side was Ohio, a slave state and a free state. And no traveler, particularly European traveler, could go down the river without making what was almost a conventional observation of the difference of life in Kentucky, which was generally figured as rude, violent, bloody, corrupt, whatever you want, and in Ohio, which was generally figured as orderly, above board, honest, hardworking, and all that. Kentucky had been settled by immigrants from Virginia. Ohio, in that region, had been settled for the most part by immigrants from New England. So you have brought together there two opposing cultures. An interesting comparison would be someone like Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, who in Evangeline, which used to be read by everyone and is now read by practically no one, deals with a very similar motif. But it's a more, I would say it's a figurative statement in general about disunity, uneasiness, some sense that there's something wrong with the country, wrong with its inheritance, and focusing on the Mississippi, on that central zone that for so long was a symbol of unity.
John, we're talking about rivers and American literature and politics and life in the 19th century. You've mentioned Evangeline, you've mentioned Thoreau and Walden, you've talked about, you've referred to Melville. And you have referred to Harriet Beecher Stowe. Is there a single work that sort of epitomizes what you're trying to do here, or is that too much of a simplification?
Well, the single work which brings so much of this together is will be one of the major emphases of the third volume, to be done, which is Huckleberry Finn, which has to be paired with Life on the Mississippi. They were written almost concurrently. In fact, a large section of Huckleberry Finn appears in Mark Twain's Life on the Mississippi and was excised from the novel when it was published. But that book most certainly brings together a great deal of what had gone before. That is to say, we must remember that both Life on the Mississippi and Huckleberry Finn are, to a very large extent, retrospective. They look back. After the Civil War, the steamboat trade, because of the railroad, declined drastically. In fact, one book I've worked with, which written by James G. Neihardt, best known for Black Elk Speaks, is called The River and I. This was published in 1907 and concerned a voyage that Neihardt took on the Missouri all by himself. He saw not one steamboat the whole length of Missouri.
It had died.
Been broken by the railroad. So Twain sees that. He also sees that although there is still a very going, vital trade on the rivers, that because of improvement in navigational devices, the pilot is no longer as important as he once was. Navigation is much easier, much quicker, everything works much better, but the pilot as hero, As a man who has tremendous power in his hands and makes great dangerous decisions, is gone.
John, earlier you mentioned Herman Melville. We're talking about American rivers and literature and politics. Let me ask you to bring in a book that that Melville wrote called The Confidence Man. What does that have to do with American rivers?
Well, that's practically it, as a matter of fact, where the river record is concerned. First of all, let's start with Moby Dick before we get to The Confidence Man. The rivers do not figure in Moby Dick. They may figure as figures of speech. I can't say they don't. But the Erie Canal does. At the center of Moby Dick is something called the Town Ho's Story.
That's right.
This is generally thought of as the seed. This was often thought of as what was probably the original story Melville had in mind. It involves mutiny and so on. And at the center of this is a geopolitical conflict between a canaler named Steelkilt and a Nantucketer named Radney.
Mm-hmm.
This will be extended, actually. The same conflict will appear again in Billy Budd under different forms. And Steelkilt is a canaller, as they were called, a canalman. And Melville puts forth the Erie Canal in terms which are absolutely written absolutely against the way in which the canal, the Erie Canal, was envisaged by its builders, which again was a great string course of unity that would pull the East and the West together and provide economic and political sanctity for the nation. Melville puts it forth as what he calls one stream of Venetianly corrupt life, as it were, a polluted vein of corruption and violence, out of which this figure Steelkilt emerges. Now, in The Confidence Man, he does practically the same thing with the Mississippi River. Now, he was, in this sense, anticipated. Frederick Marryat, best known as Captain Marryat, and again an author of sea fiction, visited America and wrote one of a number of attacks by British travelers on American life. And he called the Mississippi one vast sewer.
When was this?
1840s.
Mm-hmm.
Not in terms of pollution today, but in terms of the human, awful, as it were, kinds of people, the awful people who were traveling the river. That in those days, we must remember, river transportation was the way you went over long distances, and the river was literally crowded. You'd have steamboats, rafts, flatboats, keelboats, practically any kind of craft the human imagination could conceive of that would float, and some didn't float for very long, but they could get off from the bank and move down with the cargo, was moving on the Mississippi. It was a crowded thoroughfare.
So what's Melville doing with this?
All right. Melville takes that fact and uses it for satiric purposes. He brings together on this steamboat, ironically called the Fidel, the Faithful, a series of interviews. There's no plot to the story. It's largely conversation between the Confidence Man, who puts on a number of disguises, and the people he is bilking, who come from various regions of the country and have different backgrounds. It's a bilking with a metaphysical, as everything Melville wrote, has a strongly metaphysical dimension. But he's using the convenient fact of the Mississippi as being a sort of central vein of American commerce, the importance of the steamboat at that time as essential to promoting that vein of commerce, in order to satirize American society and a number of institutions. Transcendentalism comes in for it, Whig optimism, polite letters, you name it. Whatever was most of the major journalistic issues of the day are treated by Melville, using the Mississippi as a vehicle. Melville's not concerned with slavery, which many of the writers of the day are. Melville's, he was in Benito Cereno. I don't mean he as a person was not, but there's a black man who is probably a white man in disguise who figures very importantly in The Confidence Man, but not as a slave, not in any political context. It was merely as a black man in cahoots with the Confidence Man.
All right, now what does Melville's view of the river and the river in American society then have to do with what you're writing about?
All right, it's quite simple. For him, as for Longfellow and for Harriet Beecher Stowe, now we're talking about a 10-year span here. We start with 1845 with Evangeline, 1850 or 51, Uncle Tom's Cabin, 1855, 56, The Confidence Man. Each one of these uses the river as a symbol of disunion.
John, you've been talking about Mark Twain and Harriet Beecher Stowe and Herman Melville. Does this mean the upshot of what you're saying here in your book about American culture and rivers? Does this mean that they're fine literary artists but bad political prophets? I mean, the country has hung together.
Well, again, to speak in their defense, I didn't mean to imply that they said it was going to fall asunder.
Okay.
What they meant to show was that what was happening was something quite different from what the forefathers had predicted.
Mm-hmm.
But for reasons which could be laid to the blame of the forefathers, that is to say, the Constitution, had accepted slavery, had not declared itself against slavery, it accepted the institution. And in fact, one of the great defenses of slavery was based on the property clause of the Constitution, which was vital to the whole meaning of the Constitution.
Yep.
As you probably know, in one early version of the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson included the slave trade against the many charges laid to poor King George, who had very little to do with the slave trade. It was very much a matter of New England, which ran it, and the South, which benefited from it. But it was decided not to put it into the Declaration of Independence because the South would take exception to that particular charge. The same with the Constitution. There was a very hot debate about whether or not slavery should be sanctified by law, and it was decided in order for the Constitution to be accepted, it would have to be. This is the first of the compromises that led to the Missouri Compromise and every other compromise that carried on down through the 19th century, against which Thoreau wrote, Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote, and other less well-known writers. Mm-hmm.
What about Washington Irving, the Hudson, all of that?
Well, again,
is he important to you?
Yes, very important to me, because Irving is dealing with, in his most famous stories, which is Ichabod Crane and Rip Van Winkle, with certain disjunctions that were current. Rip Van Winkle, remember, Rip's brought back from a long sleep to confront progress. A lot of people were confronting progress in America in 1820. The Erie Canal was underway. A steamboat had just been invented. There were talks of rail lines, by which they meant horse-drawn rail lines, but they were already talking about railroads. Change was very rapid, and that story, and a lot of it having to do with the kinds of change that rivers and canals were going to bring about, and that story registers that uneasiness over change. In Irving's, it's purely political, but nonetheless change. In Ichabod Crane, the tension is between the Dutch settlers who inhabit the Hudson River Valley and Ichabod Crane, who is a Yankee, who is invading it and trying to, as you remember, steal the farmer's daughter in order to get her lands, which he's going to sell and go farther west. Now, yeah. I'm not sure you remember that as being an important part of the story of Ichabod Crane.
We
remember the headless Hessian and the pumpkin and the prank. Mm-hmm. But the pumpkin and the prank come out of a very definite sectional rivalry between New England and New York, a rivalry which was eventually to be eaten up by the larger sectional rivalry between the North and the South, in which the same issues obtained, the pastoral stability of New York under the Dutch is translated to the pastoral stability of the plantation system. The busybody.
You take all the fun out of it.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. That's part of the curse of being a critic. And the Yankee, the invader, the person who is, you know, messing around with regions where he doesn't belong, is translated into the general terms of the North.
And how does this come back to rivers?
The river serves as a focus. It's a fact, of course, in the Hudson River Valley. It serves as a focus for these tensions, which are defined by borders. As it were, the Yankees are on the east side of the Hudson and the Yorkers on the west side of the Hudson, if you want to metaphorize it. In the South, it ultimately, literally, it's the Potomac. It becomes the great borderline, although Maryland was parlous. Nonetheless, ultimately, the Potomac was literally the battle line. I mean, the South, forces of the South were south of the Potomac, forces of the North were north of the Potomac, and the massive irony is that the man for whom Washington was named, George himself, saw the Potomac in his vision as the great route west. The Potomac would be would carry the Americans into the Allegheny Mountains, a system of canals and inclined plains, which were rail lines, basically, but drawn not by steam but by mechanical means, and then canals on the other side, the Monongahela, and down to the Ohio Valley. This was the great system that Washington and Jefferson both promoted very ardently in their correspondence and a lot of private maneuverings, but it was the Erie Canal which won out, and because the Erie Canal won out, everything changed. The whole shape of the country aligned itself east and west, not south and west, which was what Washington wanted. So the Potomac, which for Washington is a great unifying river, becomes
the dividing
100 years
line.
Later, less than 100 years later, the great divider.
Right.
Another, as it were, the flow was not from the Potomac to the Hudson. I mean, from the Potomac to the Ohio, but rather the other way. The Ohio, which is the divided river from the very start, free, north, on the north bank, south slave on the south bank. As it were, backflows down the Potomac, making it a divided river also.
As part of the paradox that you mentioned earlier. John, let's conclude. Tell me, you're speaking to a general audience. What one writer or one work would you have people know about to get to your topic of rivers and American literature?
Well, again, I think since everyone has probably read Huckleberry Finn, we can leave that one out. I mean, let's assume everyone has read that or should have. If they haven't, it's like paying your income taxes. You know, you're doing wrong. I would say probably the next most important book in terms of what I'm doing, is still A Week in the Concord and the Merrimack. This is a book
of
Henry David Thoreau, Week in the Concord and the Merrimack. You can, as with Moby Dick, if you want, the form is very similar. You have a narrative interrupted by philosophical chapters. And Samuel Eliot Morison once said, the way to enjoy Moby Dick is to skip the cetology chapters and just stick to the narrative. And it's a great story, he said, if you keep away from the philosophy. And I suppose I could say the same thing, that it's a more enjoyable travel narrative if you skip every other chapter and just stay with the narrative. But of course, you miss the weightier part, the treasure of the book. That's a book, I think, unjustly neglected by general as well as specialized readers. Another book by Thoreau that might be the best way to start is a series of three essays put together by his literary executors called The Maine Woods, which has to do with Thoreau's travels on the Allegash East Branch rivers that more lately were associated with the nature writer John McPhee, who wrote about his experiences on those rivers. And this is a much more modern and available Thoreau. People who are interested in river travel, whitewater sports, and so on, I think would find this is quite a different writer from the one they remember from their collision with Walden. So I would suggest you start with the Maine Woods, those three narratives, then move to Week in the Concord and the Merrimack and see how it hangs together.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation with one scholar who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. John Seeley is a professor at the University of Florida. Our topic was Professor Seeley's forthcoming study entitled Beautiful Machine, the second in a three-volume series about rivers in American life and literature. The first book in the sequence is entitled Prophetic Waters, published by Oxford University Press in 1977. John Seeley is the general editor in the Penguin American Library series and the author of books and articles about 19th century American writing. Soundings concludes now with a review of two recent books about American literature. The first of these is John Updike's Hugging the Shore, a collection of critical essays. The second is Mordecai Rischler's collection entitled The Best of Modern Humor. Here with review comments is Robert Ginger, book critic for the Greensboro, North Carolina News and Record.
Writing criticism is to writing fiction and poetry as hugging the shore is to sailing in the open sea. John Updike is at the top of his form, not in adventurous sailing, but in watching both small and large craft from the safe haven of the shore. Certainly Hugging the Shore has received the praise it deserves. Updike's erudition and immense capacity to wonder inform these essays and criticism. Then why is much of this criticism bland, as if Updike writes with 99 parts of curiosity, but only one part of conviction? Well, honest criticism, by definition, is judgmental. A critic with convictions will necessarily find himself on the rancor generosity scale somewhere between Darth Vader and Mr. Rogers. Updike demonstrates his intelligence throughout the collection. His intellectual grasp and knack at comparative analysis are formidable. But without the sustaining allegiances of the heart, we are apt to end up with intelligent anemia here. His fiction is the same. I've been convinced for years he has something to say. It's not a question of what, but of how. Insights, emotions, epiphanies are sidestepped for rides on intellectual carousels. How, for example, does an author reveal or understand the state of weeping? Can he evoke it, or does he reduce the mystery of a tear to what another writer calls a minor exudation of the lacrimatory gland? Both in his own imaginative writing and in his perception of those literary craft offshore, Updike tends to be reflective and reductive, but brilliant. Characteristically, he sublimates experience through the medium of a style which sacrifices original force for elegance, and which, however clever, often seems thin, derivative. Updike discusses his own books as well as others, from W. H. Auden to Edmund Wilson, most others. The New York critics remind us that Norman Mailer is conspicuously absent from this collection. These valuable tours in Updike's boat, skirting the sea of imaginative writing, should be taken cautiously, with your own constitutionally emotional life buoy and plenty of philosophical Dramamine. Some selections in Mordecai Richler's recent collection of modern humor are alone worth the price of the book. Tom Wolfe's essay, The Mid-Atlantic Man, perfectly captures the frigid distance of English manners when confronted by the phenomenon of the American pal. Peter's fine yet languid face, his casual yet inviolate wavy thatchy hair, that old ancient thing, class, now has him, and he can't introduce Peter by his first name. Kurt Vonnegut Jr.'s report on the Barnhouse effect is included. I realized with surprise that I'd read this one way back in a high school anthology. Professor Barnhouse can alter matter with his mind in a way that would shame Uri Geller. While world governments seek to harness his power for defense, he begins to destroy the world's armaments one by one. Terry Southern's hilarious essay, I Am Mike Hammer, is a hilarious, not the usually supercilious or facile look at Mickey Spillane. The late A.J. Liebling's dead-on portrait of Governor Earl Long, excerpted from his famous The Earl of Louisiana, is that kind of triumph which raises journalism, necessarily ephemeral, to the level of enduring literature. Peter DeVries' Requiem for a Noun, or Intruder in the Dusk, is a very funny account of what can come of trying to read William Faulkner while minding a child, or vice versa. DeVries writes in high, mocking admiration of the Faulkner idiom, "We are mocked first by the old mammalian snare, then snared by the final unilaterality of all flesh to which birth is given, not only not knowing when we may be cuckolded, but not even sure that in the veins of the very bantling we dandle does not flow the miscreant, sniggering, wayward blood." E.B. White's Across the Street and Into the Girl, with respects to Ernest Hemingway, is almost as good. Priceless are Groucho Marx's letters to Warner Brothers, who threatened legal action if the Marx Brothers made a satire of Casablanca, and to Gummo Marx, recounting dinner with his celebrated pen pal T.S. Eliot. Richler includes poet Marianne Moore's exchanges with Ford Motor Company over the name of a new car. Ford wanted Miss Moore to help them with a name that would convey, through association or other conjuration, some visceral feeling of elegance, fleetness, and advanced features and design. Miss Moore's suggestions, such as Dearborn Diamante, were discarded for another which had a certain ring to it, an air of gaiety and zest. At least that's what we keep saying. Our name, dear Miss Moore, is Edsel. I have some objections to the Richler anthology. The Stanley Elkin piece is one of his worst, not best. But basically the selections are good. Satire by Robert Benchley, Damon Runyon, Ring Lardner, P.G. Woodhouse, Stella Gibbons, Russell Baker, and about 36 others makes The Best of Modern Humor a notable collection.
The comments of Robert Ginger, book critic for the Greensboro, North Carolina News and Record. His topics were John Updike's collection of critical essays entitled Hugging the Shore and Mordecai Richler's recent collection entitled The Best of Modern Humor. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center with the second in a series of discussions about American literature. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about American writing in the 19th century. My guests will be Olaf Hansen of the University of Frankfurt and Everett Emerson of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.